Talk given Friday, 12th January, 1973. Today, we will go on to the attempt to convey the idea of a unitary God, which one sees in the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda never produced anything like a unitary God in the sense that the theistic religions produced. There was a movement towards it, but it never culminated in producing the idea of the one and only true and absolute God, a personal being. The other branch of the Indo-Aryan peoples, the one which migrated westwards into Iran and produced the whole of the Zarathustrian teaching, that was the branch which produced the idea of a purely spiritual and ethical supreme power, which they named Ahura-Mazda. But the Rig Vedic Indians never did. The Rig Veda culminates with tendencies towards monism. It actually expresses throughout the hymns what Max Müller called, he coined the word himself, henotheism. And there were theistic leanings all along the line, but never culminating in a true theism, nor actually producing a pure monism. I use the word henotheism. The meaning of that word is just this. One of the interesting features of the hymns of the Rig Veda is that whenever any of the holy ones is composing a hymn to any particular god, he generally presents that god as the highest and the supreme amongst all the others. And if he produces a hymn to another god, then that god will become the supreme amongst all of them. So you see, this is the phenomenon which Max Müller designed as henotheism. Now, in the 10th book, we have a few quite interesting hymns which show a tendency towards a monotheistic concept, but which never culminates in a real monotheism. This is a hymn to Vishwakarman. There are only two important hymns to Vishwakarman, strangely enough. Mighty in mind and power is Vishwakarma, maker, disposer, and most lofty presence. Their offerings joy in rich juice, where they speak of one, only one, beyond the seven rishis, the seven great seers. Father who made us, he who, as disposer, knoweth all races and all things existing, even he alone, the deity's name-giver, him other beings seek for information. That which is earlier than this earth and heaven, before the asuras and the gods. The asuras are the forces who are counterbalanced by the suras, the forces which build up and the forces which break down, in order that the universal process may go on. What was the germ primeval which the waters received, where all the gods were seen together? Here is the question, here is the search. what was the germ primeval, which the waters received, where all the gods were seen together. As we might profitably spend a few moments looking into this particular couplet. First, the composer of the hymn states, "That which is earlier than this earth and heaven, before the asuras and the gods had being." He's seeking for ultimate origins. What was the germ primeval which the waters received? Now, which the waters received. Wherever you find this term waters, you have the negative, the feminine aspect of the activity which goes on in some of the very deep states of consciousness. It is the feminine, the negative so-called, which is the really active one. The male, the positive, is the passive one. The male, by presence, pure presence, does the needful. It's the supreme mystery, the influence, the magic, the unknowability aspect. The waters represent the female aspect of things. So the waters, where oneself is concerned, represent, that's that activity of the mind in deep meditation, which is going to produce afterwards, when one emerges out of it, the thought structure and the words which will represent this deep state. That is what the waters represent. The waters themselves fertilize, as we know in physical terms. They make the soil fertile and so forth. The waters are fertilizers. And the waters are also the containers of the fertilized germ or seed or whatever it may be. They have this dual function. You find in the Kabbalah, Bina, intelligence, presented as containing within itself the duals. Chokhmah, wisdom, has no duality. Chokhmah is the male. And by mere presence, fecundates Bina, which starts up the interaction of the positive-negative, male-female, all within intelligence. Now the waters represent that type of working of the deeps of the mind. This, of course, is the ancient teaching. Whether we in modern times, through our modes of investigation, will be able to find some sort of confirmation or correspondence with what those people taught, I don't know. We must just wait and see what happens. So, what was the germ primeval which the waters received, where all the gods were seen together? Now, the poet says that all the gods were seen together there. What does he mean? The gods are different modes in which the transcendent energy of pure mind manifests itself. And those those modes which on their own plane are indescribable, when they come through down to our level here, because our discursive mind and sense perceptions analyze everything, docket them and put them into their proper place and so forth, because our structure here is like that. The gods as such then are seen together there as one. Then he goes on, the waters, they received the germ primeval, wherein the gods were gathered all together. It rested set upon the unborn's navel, that one wherein abide all things existing. It rested set upon the unborn's navel, that one wherein abide all things existing. In yoga, in the yoga system, you know the importance of the navel, the center, as they say, at the navel. It is the center which is responsible for the whole of the digestive process. The digestive process, not merely biologically, but psycho-spiritually. Perhaps psychically is sufficient for us. The psychical digestion which goes on of all our experience, all our sense impressions which come to us throughout the day. Again, it is our link when we are born, or before we were born, with the mother from the navel. We are linked up by the umbilical cord to the mother. And then after birth, that is cut, and we are on our own. I think it is better, perhaps it's more constructive, to see this, not that we are separate beings from our mothers, but that we are on our own now, although still in relationship with the mother. We never lose the relationship. We cannot. If we did, and there was nothing which stood in the place of mother, we'd perish. That's all. But we are on our own in a new relationship. It rested upon the unborn, the germ primeval rested upon the unborn's navel, that one wherein abide all things existing. See, I'm reading this slowly and I'm repeating the lines because the mind must absorb sensitively that which the words try to convey. The Rig Vedic hymns are amongst the most difficult to understand, really. You can't give a literal meaning pat off. Then the seventh verse, ye will not find him who produced these creatures, the poet says. Another thing hath arisen up among you, enwrapped in misty cloud with lips that stammer, hymn chanters wander and are discontented. This is how the seer ends the hymn. Extremely significant. ye will not find him who produced these creatures. The ultimate reality, the truth, the final thing, as one might say, is the unknowable. Another thing hath arisen up amongst you. What is the meaning of this other thing that has arisen up amongst you? The picture which is manufactured by my thought and speech process. The experiencing is a reality. But when that particular state of experiencing has come to its end, and one seeks to give it shape and form, that is to say, one seeks to give shape and form to that which is everlastingly shapeless and formless, which is illimitable. When one tries to give shape and form to that which is illimitable, necessarily the whole thing has lost at least one dimension of reality. Have we ever tried to pack a solid object into a sheet of paper? Even a sheet of paper has three dimensions, but you know what I mean. Can't do it. And yet, if there is that extent of realization and that genius which has come to flower within the purified one, his words will have some power of making the devotee, the listener, click with the reality within himself. Otherwise, all these words and statements are utterly useless. You can put the whole lot of scripture into the waste paper basket. But it does make one click, provided there is within the seeker after truth the real caring for it, the real selflessness. Nothing to gain, nothing to achieve. It is very, very hard to realize. Watch life incessantly within oneself. We are all the time grasping. The whole mind process is a grasping process. As it functions through the activity of the senses. So we grasp at ideas. We want to grasp at truth. We want to grab hold of God. Can't be done. Can this hand catch hold of itself? It can catch hold of something other than itself. It can't catch hold of itself. The ultimate real is the one who is trying to grasp. And the one who is trying to grasp the ultimate real, therefore, is just chasing a will-o'-the-wisp. One may see this intellectually, but we don't really get it. Otherwise, there'd be such an operation of the Lord of Fire that all greed, grasping, avarice, etc., would be just burnt out. There'd be pure vision. The fire of Agni would be like the light of the sun. Agni's supreme station is the sun in the heavens, as the Rig Veda puts it. That sort of thing has enormous consequences in our everyday life. Our circumstance changes. I think I've mentioned this before. What is our inner state of awareness is the mysterious power that produces our whole situation. And that inner state of awareness is something which emerges and is perfect and beautiful and free in itself. It emerges insofar as we don't obstruct it with our desires, our conceptions and ideas and beliefs and all the rest of it. See, these old people really knew all this absolutely inside out. That's how they were able to produce hymns of this type. So, another thing hath arisen up among you, enwrapped in mystic cloud, with lips that stammer, hymn chanters wander and are discontented. Because the hymn chanter would like to produce the hymn which was God in a nutshell. You can't do it. Now, Vishwakarman, one of the meanings is the all-maker. Vishwa, all-karma. Maker, all creator. He is referred to as the all creating one. And don't forget that the concept of the gods is something which is realized within oneself, because the Holy One realizes that in actual fact He is the all-creating one within. Therefore, he's trying to present this as the ultimate real. As one of the great things that the Holy Ones discovered, whoever they were, and to whichever faith they belonged, they discovered their own limitations, the unknowability of ultimate things. If we once know that we don't know and we cannot know transcendence, the infinite, the absolute, then we have the best. We have the greatest freedom within ourselves to get on with the actual practical task of watchfulness, of mindfulness, by means of which we can be least obstructive to the reality functioning through us. We have the power of obstruction as no kingdom of nature has. And religious study and the discipline of religion all works towards freeing us from bondage to this obstructive power in our being. When that is done, so much unnecessary suffering is out of the situation. It just isn't there. But to seek to get rid of suffering is hopelessly mistaken. It's the wrong way. We have to utilize suffering just as we have to utilize what we call the pleasant in order to learn. And to learn really means to grow. To grow inwardly in mind. That is the real meaning of learning. It's the growth of the mind. Not an acquiring by the mind. The study of the essence of religion means to let the mind grow. The essence of religion. The external form of religion is contacted through our senses, particularly, of course, sight, hearing, and then the activity of the brain, and so forth. That's the external form of it. But this inner essence of religion, this formless, shapeless sensitivity must go out and work livingly upon that external form and shape, and let the shape vanish, disappear. After all, when the lovely birthday cake or Christmas cake, beautifully wrapped up, is to be eaten, you remove the paper covering, if there is one, don't you? Or does anyone eat that also? See, it's like that. Let that be cast aside, the form of the thing. So this all creativeness which is in us, Vishwakarman, and if we can deal with everything in our life with this aspect of Vishwakarman operating, our whole life activity from moment to moment every day becomes a creative activity. This is what we've got to learn. Now, we'll look at one other hymn, which is quite important. In the beginning rose Hiranyagarbha. Hiranya means gold, Garbha means womb. It's sometimes translated as the golden germ or the golden egg. But Garbha literally means womb. Born only Lord of all created beings, He fixed and holdeth up this earth and heaven, giver of vital breath, of power and vigor, He whose commandments all the gods acknowledge, whose shade is death, whose lustre makes immortal, who by his grandeur hath become sole ruler of all the moving world that breathes and slumbers, He who is Lord of men and Lord of cattle. I've used the literal translation cattle. I don't know what the Vedic word actually used there is. But we'll leave it at that. By him the heavens are strong and earth is steadfast. By him light's realm and sky vault are supported. By him the regions in mid-air were measured. He in his might surveyed the floods containing productive force and generating worship. He is the God of gods, and none beside him. And each verse ends with the fourth line of each verse is, what God shall we adore with our oblation? If you can lay your hands on the Rig Veda, copies are available, it is well worthwhile spending some weeks meditating upon any one of these great hymns. Now, Hiranyagarbha, the golden womb. We can understand Hiranyagarbha a little more clearly this way. You all know the word Brahman. It is the supreme word together with the word Atma in the Upanishads, Brahman. And you will find in many Upanishads the statement that in Brahman is Mula Prakruti. Mula Prakruti means the root principle of manifestation. I am using the word manifestation, which is the word commonly used, Prakruti is primordial nature, which is an excellent way of presenting Prakruti, primordial nature. But you'll see why I'm using the root principle of manifestation in this context. Now, Mula Prakruti, when reflected in Brahman, this is how the Upanishads teach it. It comes in one of the little known Upanishads, the Paingala. Comes in other Upanishads too. When Mula Prakruti is reflected in Brahman, then there emerges the witness self. Mula Prakruti, the root. Mula is root. Root, you see, the root of primordial nature, the root of manifestation, reflected in Brahman, who is generally presented for philosophical purposes as pure absolute consciousness. Reflected in this pure consciousness gives rise to the witness self. That is to say, gives rise to the faculty of looking within your own self, applied to us now. When we say that we are observing ourselves, observer and observed are the same, aren't they? This power of self-seeing is an extraordinary thing. The mind only can do that. Our eyes cannot see our own eyes. They can see other parts of the body, but a part of the body too near the eyes, for example the eyebrows, cannot be seen by one's own eyes. And certainly the eyes can't see themselves. But the rest of the body, or at least a good bit of the rest of the body, the major part of it, can be seen by the eyes. Now with the mind it is different. The mind can see the whole of itself if it exercises its faculty of seeing, of looking within. It can see the whole of itself. It can witness itself. This is an important thing, and this is where we are fundamentally different from the other kingdoms of nature. So now, this gives rise to the witness self. Now, when Mula Prakruti starts changing, due to the preponderance of sattva, as it is called. Sattva has several meanings: truth, light, rhythm, being, pure being, conceptual being, that means, or absolute being, perhaps, sad, the sattvic quality, which is utterly pure, perfect. So, when mula prakriti changes, due to the preponderance of sattva, it becomes the unmanifested. And it has the power of veiling Brahman. Now, here we can begin to bite onto something. Brahman or Atma, either word, represents you yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, completely alert, awake, unresisting. Ah, when you yourself in that state are the focus or nexus through which transcendent energy, the transcendence itself, flows in and out without let or hindrance of any sort. That is the meaning of the word Brahman or Atma. I can't put it in clearer language. This is something which you will experience for yourself. The Christian mystic would say, it is granted by grace only. In India, we don't say that. We don't make it exclusively a granting through grace by a transcendent deity. It is something, the Buddha, for instance, openly said, that the bhikkhu can enter into these states as he pleases, when he pleases, and move out of them as he pleases, when he pleases, into the deep states of consciousness. And at the same time, although the Buddha put it in those words, or rather those are the words attributed to him, it is also stated very clearly, and the Buddha again confirms that when he talks of Sariputta, Sariputta himself says it. But when this state supervened, it was not as if I was entering into the state. And on emerging out of that state, it was not as if I emerged out of that state. See, these things must be very carefully understood, because this lies right at the heart of religious experiencing and living. So, this unmanifested has the power of veiling Brahman. What is reflected in the unmanifested is the Ishvara consciousness. Ishvara is the personal God idea. Through self-strength, self-power, Ishvara. Now, Ishvara has Maya under control. Maya is that creative power which gives rise to the ephemeral appearance which we call the universe. And it is because the whole universal becoming process is ephemeral that some, particularly teachers like Shankara, have called it a pure illusion and no reality to it. But we won't argue about that now. Ishvara has Maya under control, is all-knowing, is the first cause of creation, the sustenance, and also the dissolution of the world. The term, the world, always meaning the world as it exists as a picture in our own mind. Not a static picture, a moving picture. When I say I see that piano, what I am seeing is the image of it which is inside my brain. I am recognizing that image and using the sound piano which I have been taught to use, conditioned to use since my childhood. So that is the world referred to. Next, from the power of veiling in Ishvara also comes the power of projection. And this is termed Mahat, due to preponderance of Rajas, which is motion, which is passion, which is a stirring into action, and so forth. Rajas. Rajas is a very interesting word. Oh, there's so much about Rajas which has to be learned. What they implied by it. Now, this word Mahat, which literally means great, I'd like to read to you what the big Monier Williams dictionary says about Mahat. First, let's look at the root, which is mah. Mah, M-A-H in English. And take the word maha. Great, mighty, strong, abundant. Now take mahat. Strong, great in space, time, quantity or degree. Large, big, huge, ample, extensive, long, abundant, numerous, considerable, important, high, eminent. And so the dictionary goes on till it touches upon this idea of the Mahat Tattva. Tattva is essential stuff. That's Tattva. The great principle, and it is the name of Buddhi. He, of course, translates it as intellect, or the intellectual principle, according to the Sankhya philosophy, the second of the 23 principles produced from Prakruti, and so called as the great source of Ahankara. Kara means maker, Ahang means I, the I maker, self-consciousness, the self-sense, as it is called. So, we must bear that in mind carefully when dealing with this word Mahat. Now, I'll read that again. From the power of veiling in Ishvara comes power of projection, Mahat, due to the preponderance of Rajas. What is reflected in it is the Hiranyagarbha consciousness, the golden womb, out of which everything emerges, the whole world as we experience it. Now, when the yogi or the person who is meditating, as in Pali we would say the jhani, who enters the jhanas, the one who enters the jhanas, enters into one of the very deep states, he enters into the state of the golden womb, the Hiranyagarbha. And if he can enter into that state, which is the golden womb, he comes to understand the origin of all those processes in the mind which he observes through ordinary mindfulness in his everyday life. You know, the mythologies of the world have presented this idea of the golden egg or the golden womb. They have also talked of the breaking of the egg, and then out of that come the primal God who makes the world and so forth. So many cultures have this kind of story in them. And this kind of story emerges because of the experience in the deep states of consciousness of that which in the Upanishads has been described in this way. Now, I selected the Paingala Upanishad to make these notes simply because this teaching is given by Yajnavalkya, a name which is probably the greatest name throughout the Upanishads. Yajnavalkya was someone quite exceptional. He was acknowledged as the Yogeshwara, the God among yogis. We usually translate it idiomatically into English as the Prince of Yogis. But Ishvara means God. Yogeshwara, Yajnavalkya. And it is he who gave this teaching to his disciple Paingala. What is reflected in it is the Hiranyagarbha consciousness. It conceives Mahat Tattva as its own and has its form manifested both distinctly and indistinctly. You see the significance? When you are inside the golden egg, everything is light. You know with the knowing which is not analytical, which is not any form of extraneous perceiving. You know it that way, and then it is completely distinct. Emerge out of that state of consciousness and the whole thing has become blurred. Now look, in a kind of a shadowy way, there is the reflection of that quite often in our daily life. When we are about to fall asleep, or when we are just emerging out of sleep, there is that curious stage where, profundity is very, very clear and simple before us. And by the time we are properly awake, or of course vice versa, thoroughly asleep, the thing has become indistinct. Now, the practice of meditation, and this is where the set practice has its use, If it is done rightly, and if there is the purity, not seeking for self anything at all, then it is, one develops the power to maintain the mind in a state of steadiness, the alertness, the conscious state in a state of steadiness. Now, if you can hold that steadiness as the body wakes up fully, you'll bring through completely the whole inspiration. This you will, you can discover out of your own practice and experience. Right. So, I trust that that gives some sort of indication of what is meant by saying both distinctly and indistinctly. Now, from the power of projection in Hiranyagarbha comes the power of making gross bodies. Now, the sentence as it stands naturally gives us the impression that you make human beings or dogs or cats or whatever it is. No. Comes the power of making gross bodies known as ahankara, the self-sense, the I-sense. It is the I-sense, this isolative self-consciousness, as I call it, which makes this living body a gross thing. This living body otherwise is transcendence itself embodied, transcendent energy embodied. I don't know this thing in its transcendent, in its transcendent condition. I know it in its gross condition. Because this is what has happened in my brain and mind. You see how the separative I puts us into the state of sin, the gross state, the mean state, the low down state. What is reflected in it is Virat consciousness, from which emerge Akasha, Vayu, Agni, Apa, Prithvi. As they translate it, ether, air, fire, water, earth. Now don't, misinterpret this as actual water, earth, and so forth. They refer to states of consciousness.